2015, given this epidemic of police violence, we need a Black Lives Matter movement that holds conventions, that has dues-paying members, that has membership cards, that has executive secretary, a chairperson of the board, that has paid staff, etc. That's on one front. We need, obviously, more tenants' unions. In certain cities, the skyrocketing of rents is just incredible. In fact, one of the major investment avenues for the sharks on Wall Street is now rental housing.
Exactly.
In fact, people are being pushed out of home ownership, and those homes are being bought by the sharks and then are rented to some of these
right
same
back
people.
To the people who lost
right.
their house.
Exactly.
Right.
And so the only way to combat that is through organization.
As Black Lives Matter protests continue in Baltimore and across the country, we'll speak to writer and activist Gerald Horn and connect these wars at home to the wars abroad. All that and more coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for May 7, 2015 on WPFW Washington, 89.3, your listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam here on this show's first day of the spring membership drive. I want to first congratulate Dave Zirin and Etan Thomas for their fundraising and their show during the last hour. And second, urge you to keep raising the energy, raising the roof for On the Ground during this hour. It's our anniversary. On the Ground launched last year on May 1st, May Day, International Workers' Day. And since that time, we've been your show based here in the DMV, dedicated to activists and activism. It's our labor of love, bringing you the voices you won't hear on the evening news or on cable news, activists protesting against war, police brutality, taking a stand for the rights of indigenous people, the survival of the internet, or of our one and only planet Earth. Because I know you value these same values of Pacifica Radio, I know you'll support this show and the station by keeping us on the air. No contribution is too small or certainly too large. You can get me started by calling 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Or pledge right online at wpfw.org. Consider becoming a sustainer for only $10 a month or better, $20 a month, and support maintaining a voice to speak truth to power here in the belly of the beast. As always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour. The prolific author and activist Professor Gerald Horn is about to join us, but first we'll start with a few headlines. The Million Moms March, supported by a broad coalition of human rights and peace activists, will be held this Saturday, May 9th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. here in Washington, D.C. The event will kick off at Mount Vernon Square, 800 Mount Vernon Place in Northwest D.C., and is scheduled to march to the Justice Department. The march was spearheaded by Maria Hamilton after the murder of her son, Dontre, by a Milwaukee police officer 1 year ago.
We're here to let our nation know that we're going to fight. I spoke with over 100 moms thus far since I decided to do the Million Moms March. And the pain is unbearable. If they're going to bring independent investigators in to look at these cases, we shouldn't have the DAs that work with these police officers make the final choice. The system is broken. They have blinders on.
For more information on the march, go to mothersforjusticeunited.org. You can also visit the Million Moms March on Facebook or just show up Saturday, 10 a.m. at Mount Vernon Square here in the district. The D.C. Labor Fest is underway with movies, music, theater, spoken word, and various events around the city all this month. For more information, go to dclabor.org. And finally, word is that tickets for Prince's surprise Rally for Peace concert in Baltimore this Sunday are selling fast. One report says that the cheapest tickets have already sold out. Other music stars are expected to join Prince and his Third Eye Girl band at the Mother's Day concert, which they hope will be a catalyst for pause and reflection. According to the press release, Prince will also take this opportunity to give back to the city hosting him by giving a portion of the proceeds to benefit a local Baltimore-based youth charity. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, we spend the rest of the show speaking with prolific author and activist Professor Gerald Horn. Stay with us and don't delay. Call 202-588-0893. Show some love for On the Ground and our anniversary. We'll be right back. I'm here with Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, author of more than 24 books, and a frequent guest across the Pacifica Network. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, on this show last week, we began to discuss how, more so than in other recent police murders, the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, with its deep scars of urban poverty, has included with it this larger picture of economic violence, of the looting of the black community. And so what has been your reaction to what's happened in Baltimore?
Well, when you speak of the looting of the black community, I think of Ferguson, Missouri, to begin with. That is to say, one of the points brought out in the Justice Department study of Ferguson was the scandal about how that city loots its black citizens through fines, through tickets, and all the rest. Despite the fact that Ferguson, Missouri happens to be the headquarters of one of the major corporations in the United States of America, that is to say Emerson Electric, which escapes, for the most part, paying a fair tax bill, which then means that the tax burden then is displaced onto these black citizens. It's a very typical U.S. story.
I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but which electric company?
Emerson.
Oh, Emerson. Okay.
Yeah. And some of that has come out with regard to Baltimore, too. I mean, certainly it's difficult to talk about what might be called the decline of Baltimore without talking about deindustrialization, the fact that Bethlehem Steel has abandoned Baltimore, taking away those working class jobs and working class jobs that helped to sustain many a black family. And it's also difficult to talk about the particular incident involving Freddie Gray without talking about the lead paint question, that is to say these rapacious landlords who don't maintain apartments and then allows paint that's studded with lead to be ingested by youth and with leading to major lawsuits. So it's been very interesting getting this broader, more kaleidoscopic picture of Baltimore. And with the murder, if I may use that term, of Freddie Gray then being placed in that overall context, I think it gives a richer picture and a more accurate picture when you draw such a portrait.
You know, probably because we've talked about your book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Whenever I hear about stories like this, like the story of Freddie Gray, I can't help but think about not only this kind of long-standing history of state violence, but also this long history of the looting mm-hmm. and the taking away of a people's wealth, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, apparently someone writing about the community where Freddie Gray lives, well, 2 weeks ago, I had an activist who's Palestinian-American, and she was on that march from New York City to Washington, and she was one of the organizers of the march. She has family in Israel, in occupied Palestine, I should say. Mm-hmm. And when she walked through the neighborhood where Freddie Gray lived,
She said it reminded her of visiting her relatives mm-hmm. in occupied territory mm-hmm. and the abandonment, the wasteland, you know, the way the community looked. And I'm also thinking that, you know, just in terms of our existence here, you know, we can look at that same type of like long-standing generations of being in poverty, being in a recession for generations.
Well, one of the things that I do find to be missing, even in some of the progressive conversation about Baltimore and this incident, is the failure to connect contemporary events with history. You know that a well-known U.S. president once said that we cannot escape history, and that remains true today, but it seems like we're trying to escape history by not connecting what's happening to black people, in, not only in Baltimore, but nationally, with this history of slavery. That is to say that we know that urban police departments, particularly below the Mason-Dixon line, particularly in former slave depots like Baltimore and Jim Crow citadels like Baltimore, that slave patrols were the origins of urban police departments come out of slave patrols. And slave patrols were, of course, established to monitor black people in particular. And you can almost see this today. That is to say, if a person like myself, who happens to be melanin rich, happens to be wander into a certain kind of neighborhood, I'll be stopped and interrogated, even though that might be of questionable legality. And you can see that almost as a direct descendant of slave patrols. That is to say, you don't want these Africans out and about without investigation or interrogation. Likewise, I would say that we oftentimes forget, and I understand why this amnesia takes place, that the black people fought against a slaveholder's republic, which is what this country was to begin with. And we fought against the establishment of a slaveholder's republic. That is to say, a nation state that's defined and energized by slavery, led by slave owners like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, et al. And as a result of fighting and losing that war, what has happened to us is what happens to any people who fight and lose a war. That is to say, you're penalized and pulverized, and so will your descendants be penalized and pulverized until you can organize sufficiently to stop that from happening. And so when, as is alleged in the indictment of the police officers in Baltimore, they make eye contact with Freddie Gray, then arrest him, then abuse and misuse him. In some ways, that's a legacy of slavery. In some ways, that's a legacy of Jim Crow. And if you look at Eric Garner in particular, that's even more of an incident that you can say is descendant from slavery. He, of course, is the young black man who was murdered on tape in right. Staten Island by the police authorities, and then an indictment did not follow. And the DA in Staten Island, who failed to bring an indictment, now is on the verge of being elected to Congress. That is to say, he's being rewarded for failing to bring an indictment. And it's clear that you can see that as a legacy of slavery, that is to say, a stigmatized population being persecuted. And this will continue to persist until we can organize sufficiently to turn the tables.
In Maryland, in Baltimore, they have the same situation that communities have in a lot of cities, where a lot of the police force is coming from outside of the mm-hmm. city. So in Baltimore, you have a lot of police being recruited from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. other parts of Maryland. And when the people were here actually from the March to Justice, they walked through Rising Sun, Maryland. And Rising Sun, Maryland is known here as kind of a seat of the Klan.
Is that right? Where is that located?
It's like going straight up Route 1 from Baltimore. And so they were met with Confederate flags. People blew black smoke on them, called them the N-word. And it's not only that part of Western Maryland or going toward Western Maryland, but it's also, they also had the same treatment in the bordering part of Pennsylvania. As I've looked at what's happened in Baltimore and looked at the composition of the police department, I'm also wondering where these police are coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, not mm-hmm. I think that there's actually not just white police officers involved in this incident, but it's something that I'm curious about. The other thing is, because you mentioned New York, is that right after State's Attorney Mosby made her announcement about the charges, there was just automatic vilification attack on her in social media.
Really?
Yes. And coming from a lot of the right-wing media, right-wing trolls online. And it reminded me of what happened to Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York after he dared to tell his son, to relate a story about telling his black son about being careful of the police. He wasn't charging anybody with anything. He wasn't accusing anybody of anything. He was just dealing with the reality that he had a black son and relating how he had to tell his son, about the issue of being on the street as a young black man and the police, something that we all have to tell our sons, who are black. And so it just reminds me of this, what seems to be a very dangerous situation where police are kind of holding on to themselves a certain power and holding themselves above the law in a certain way, and even challenging elected officials, people who are elected by the people, to about that power.
Well, you raise a number of interesting points. When you're talking about de Blasio, obviously that pressure against him has, quote, worked, unquote, because in the recent protests that took place in New York with regard to the killing of Freddie Gray, the New York City Police Department were hyper-aggressive, and which has attracted a certain amount of attention in the New York City press, and de Blasio has been defending that approach. So obviously he's gotten the message, and that shows that we have some work to do, particularly since de Blasio was elected, not least because of a significant and substantial black vote. And now it seems that because of the pressure from the police department, he's tending to turn. But there's another lesson here, too, I think, for all of us. And once again, I have to resort to history. I think we have to step back for a moment and look at the big picture and recognize that in the African journey in North America, from slavery to Jim Crow to post-Jim Crow, one of the major reasons why Jim Crow began to retreat, particularly in the 1960s, was that there were African liberation movements taking place that the United States had to try to appeal to. There were African diplomats coming to Washington, traveling from Washington to New York on the highways, being subjected to Jim Crow. It became very difficult to distinguish them from ordinary black American citizens, even though there was a proposal at one point that they be given special buttons that they could wear so that they could go into restaurants and not be treated like black Americans. But obviously, that was a non-starter. In other words, sort of honorary white status, so to speak. And so we were able to ride that wave and achieve a certain kind of retreat from Jim Crow. But now we're in a different historical moment, and it seems like our antagonists recognize that. And it seems like our antagonists now feel that they have a lot of ground to make up, given the ground that they had to relinquish since the 1960s. Right. Hence, you see this spate of police killings and the defense of police killings as well. I mean, the fact, sadly enough, that many of us are surprised that there was a speedy indictment of these officers shows what's happening psychologically. I mean, somebody gets killed, and we're surprised that somebody's going to have to stand trial. I mean, that shows you what kind of moment we're in right now. But when I think of Maryland in particular, this is something that I think really needs interrogation and deep thought, is that if you examine the later stanzas of the Star Spangled Banner, the national anthem of the United States of America, drafted as a result of incidents that took place in Maryland by Francis Scott Key, you'll find specific and explicit attacks on the black community in the national anthem of the United States of America. This is quite extraordinary, that you'll have a national anthem that's supposed to unify the country, and yet in later stanzas, there are attacks on Maryland blacks. Why is that, you ask? Well, of course, the Star-Spangled Banner comes out of the War of 1812 and the British-U.S. War. And of course, many of the enslaved Africans in Maryland found it difficult to stand shoulder to shoulder with their slave owners, and they were defecting to the British side. And this was angering and infuriating people like Francis Scott Key, and he lets loose in the Star-Spangled Banner. So when you have a national anthem that attacks you, you shouldn't be surprised by anything that happens to you from that point forward.
Well, Do you know the stanzas? Do you know the
No,
lyrics?
I haven't committed it to memory. But, you know, that's why we have search engines. We could probably call it up in 30 seconds.
Okay, well, we'll do that before. Maybe we can do that before the end of the show. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Jim Crow, and when we come back from, we're going to take a little break and, you know, do a little pitching. But I want you to talk about Jim Crow and actually the conference that you were here for related to the Vietnam War. But right now I want to encourage everyone to go to their phones and dial 202-588-9739 and support On the Ground during our spring fundraiser. We are here with Gerald Horn, who is often here to help us to break down these issues, unpack these issues. And we have today an offer for you if you want to go to your phone and become a member or renew your membership of his book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. And we can, for a pledge of $75, you can have that book. And it really kind of unpacks a lot of the issues that we're talking about, the roots of them. And you can get the book today to support WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, by calling 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. We're going to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to move on and talk about the relationship of these issues of state violence and war at home, basically, and war abroad.
I should also mention that, as ever, I'll autograph the book and send it to your loved ones. Special delivery.
That's right. So what holiday would be coming up? I don't know.
Well, I think it's particularly appropriate for
graduation,
even for July 4th, because it's the flip side of July 4th, actually.
Exactly. So for graduations, informing graduates, informing your loved ones for Independence Day, in quotation marks, Gerald Horn's book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. We'll be right back.
Love come quick, love come in a hurry. There are thieves in the temple tonight. They don't care where they kick, just as long as they hurt you. There are thieves in the temple tonight. Save me from all this cold despair. I can hang when you're around, but I surely die if you're not there. Love, come quick. Love, come in a hurry. There'll be thieves in the temple tonight.
Well, thank you, Katia and Mike, for holding it down in the studio.
I'm here with Gerald Horn, activist and writer, professor at the University of Houston. And we're continuing our discussion about Baltimore, about, you know, everything that's really kind of happening between economics and war. So of course, as charges were brought against six officers last Friday, that was the same day that you were among those gathering here in D.C. to mark the 50th anniversary of the birth of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, which I learned in the course of this is called by the Vietnamese the War of United States Aggression, right? Mm-hmm. So there are obviously a lot of parallels that we can draw between that time and now, war at home, war abroad. At that time, we were still trying to vanquish Jim Crow for good, and now there seems to be a new Jim Crow. For example, Freddie Gray was arrested illegally, which is the same pattern. So what are your thoughts about comparing then and now?
Well, it's very interesting. As I think about that, I think about the fact that in the late 19th century, when France begins to move into the area we refer to as Indochina, which includes Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, you also see the European powers beginning to carve up of Africa with the Congress of Berlin of 1884, for example. And in fact, I think one of the points we oftentimes lose sight of when we think of the latter stages of European colonialism is how the major powers, particularly Britain and France, were so dependent upon troops from Africa and India in particular to have conquests. I mean, for example, if you look at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam in the early 1950s, when France is finally routed and chased out of Vietnam, you have African soldiers fighting under the French flag against the Vietnamese, and of course are taken prisoner and are slaughtered on the battlefield of Vietnam. And likewise, with regard to the war of U.S. aggression, it's no secret you probably have relatives who fought under the U.S. flag against the Vietnamese. I know I do. And we all know that during that particular war, one of the major points of controversy was the idea that black men in particular were being disproportionately slaughtered on the battlefields of Indochina under the U.S. flag. We also know, to flip the coin, that in the U.S. Navy, you had blacks who were conscripted or who volunteered but then turned against the war, and therefore U.S. battleships became these seething cauldrons of conflict. I mean, it seemed as if the soldiers were spending more time, U.S. soldiers fighting each other across racial lines, than they were fighting the Vietnamese. This leads to major investigations by Elmo Zumwalt, who then was the head of the Navy, and it leads to congressional investigation. In fact, somebody could write a very interesting book about that. I mean, there's been some work about the conflict, but not in the depth that I think could easily be attained.
You know, I suppose that if we can listen to Muhammad Ali's comments that he made, which were widely distributed and probably had a lot to do with the sentiment among the black soldiers. You know, this is someone who was respected and admired, saying, "I'm not going to go kill these poor, you know, shoeless people, poor, dark people." And, you know, they never called me, well, he said the N-word, right?
Right, exactly. And then there's the overriding issue, which still remains relevant today. As we sit here in Washington, D.C., and a stone's throw from here, you have these barbarians cutting up the national income and the national budget, doling out billions upon billions to the Pentagon, whereas food stamps are on the chopping block. Aid to Section 8 housing is on the chopping block, labor rights are on the chopping block, et cetera. So it's almost as if the more things change, the more they remain the same. That is to say, we were struggling decades ago with regard to this genocidal war in Vietnam and trying to wage a struggle that would ensure that our tax dollars would go for education and health care and people's needs. And here in 2015, there's the same battle. And in some ways, we're in a more disadvantageous position in 2015 than we were at the height of the Vietnam War.
I think so. And when you say that, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that at least during the height of the Vietnam War, we had wind in our sails, just like in our previous discussion in terms of these African liberation movements arising. You had a socialist camp that had yet to be collapsed. And you had more people on the march. You had a number of people who were coming into a kind of militant consciousness. But with these ideological victories that U.S. imperialism has attained in recent decades, we've really been pushed back. I mean, if you look at the number of strikes that are taking place in the 21st century versus the number of strikes that were taking place in the 1960s, it's like night and day. Obviously, a turning point was the rise of Ronald Reagan's presidency and the crushing of the air traffic controllers in 1981. And since that time, it seems that we've been fighting an uphill battle.
In talking about those ideological battles or those victories of imperialism and empire, you know, there's this raging debate right now about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, commonly known as the TPP, which sounds like basically a corporate takeover. And when you look at the global reach of something like that compared to the impoverished people of Baltimore, who are having to scrape by, not have jobs, not have schools and recreation centers, it just seems like that gap magnifies the problem.
Well, clearly. I mean, the TPP is like NAFTA on steroids. And we all know what happened with the North American Free Trade Agreement, as it was called euphemistically under Bill Clinton, where we were promised the moon and we got a dirt bag. That is to say that it facilitated the fleeing of jobs, the fleeing of good-paying manufacturing jobs in particular that has had significant impact on a city like Baltimore, helping to drive people further into impoverishment.